This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. A resounding cheer from the demonstrators at Standing Rock. After months of protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Army Corps of Engineers says it will look for an alternative route for the project. The pipeline was originally set to run under a dammed-off portion of the Missouri River near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Nathan Rott is a national reporter with NPR, and he's been covering the story from Standing Rock and joins us now from there. Hello, Nate.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. The Army Corps of Engineers obviously denying the construction permit for the current route. Give us a sense of the reaction and what you've seen at the camp.
Well, so I am not at the camp now. I'm actually a little about 10 miles south of it at a casino lodge here in Cannonball. This crazy blizzard came in and kind of snowed everybody in. But when the decision came out at the camp, it was a bit mixed. Some people were really, really excited. Tempered enthusiasm is kind of what I've been saying, because people were excited to hear the news. Obviously, it was a victory for most of the people there, but nobody really felt like it was a knockout punch. There's still a lot of concerns about what a Trump administration could do to try to overturn that decision. The pipeline company itself is seeking legal ways of getting around it. And so there's a lot of things still to play out.
All right. Let's talk more about Energy Transfer Partners, the investors who are putting the pipeline in. What's the latest? What are you hearing from them about their strategy and what they plan to do next? Do we know?
The pipeline company, Energy Transfer Partners, said that the decision was purely political, and they say that they have permission to build the pipeline beneath the river where it was previously scheduled. They said that, you know, they had already had findings from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which gave them the right of way to construct, operate, and maintain the pipeline beneath that federal land. And they said that they found no significant reason not to when they did their first appraisal of this whole thing. And so what they're going to do is they're going to try to get a court to basically say as much, to give a summary judgment on it, which would hopefully help influence future moves.
Yeah. And so what about alternates now, if they are unsuccessful in that? Have alternate routes been chosen? Have they been considered? Do we know where it might go should they fail to get a legal remedy?
No, it'll be a while before that's decided, too. I mean, so essentially what the decision by the Army Corps did was it said that they're going to do an entirely new environmental impact statement with this. And so that's going to mean looking at those alternative routes, looking at possible cultural issues that could come up with an alternate route, all the things that they did the first time around. There was one of the proposed routes before the route that they have now was going through Bismarck. That's a lot of people here at the camp that I was at were talking about how, you know, well, they won't put the pipeline through Bismarck, but they'll put it through here next to us. So that might be brought up again. I would imagine they're going to explore all sorts of different routes. And another thing that I've been saying, and I think it's important for people to remember, is that, you know, if this pipeline doesn't get built, I mean, the oil from the Bakken is still going to be moved. And what's happening a lot is a lot of that oil is getting moved by freight rail, by train. And the pipeline company, people that work in the energy and infrastructure industry, are quick to point out that objectively, freight rail transfer of oil is more accident prone than pipeline. So that's an argument that they're making to say, hey, we should try to find a way to approve this pipeline quickly.
Let's talk again about the atmosphere at the camp in the aftermath. Again, you talked about skepticism. There are a number of people who say they're going to remain at the camp because it's still questionable about what might happen in the near future. And also thousands of U.S. military veterans joined the demonstrations. What was your sense of the impact of that on those demonstrators who had been there for a long, long time?
I mean, it was a lift for everybody that was here and had been here for months on end. I mean, to get thousands of people to pour in the weekend before people were told to evacuate. I mean, that's a big boost for the spirits of everyone. And I talked to a number of veterans, too, who, you know, felt like they were really the kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, with this whole decision. They said that by sending so many people here, by having that many people in force, and by having that many veterans, it forced the Obama administration to try to find a way to sort of de-escalate the situation further. Tribal leaders and local law enforcement had been meeting ahead of time with some of the leaders of this group of veterans, and they had made some moves themselves to de-escalate the situation. There's a bridge that had been kind of all the videos that people had seen of tear gas and of and water cannons and all that. That was near that bridge. Yesterday, they moved everybody back from that bridge, kept people at bay. So those efforts were already underway. But there's no doubt that by making this decision, it definitely eased people's concerns for at least the short term.
Nathan Rott is a national reporter for NPR. Thanks so much, Nate.
Thank you.
Native demonstrators from North Carolina also played a hand in supporting the Standing Rock Sioux. Gilliam Jackson is a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. He traveled to Standing Rock to bring supplies to activists. We talked to him last week, and he's back today. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us is Keith Brashot. He's a professor of Indian law at UNC Chapel Hill and a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota. Keith, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Gilliam, I want to start with you. What was your reaction to the announcement by the Corps that they're going to not permit the continuation of that pipeline?
Well, I was excited at first, and then I kind of backed off and said, is this a fact? And then it just started popping up in the news, NBC, ABC, CNN, and after a few minutes, I decided it must be true. It was almost too much to believe, but at the same time, I backed off again and said, hey, you know, this is just, this is not the final punch.
Well, what about that? Second time we've heard this phrase, not the knockout punch, Keith Brashot. Legally, where do we stand? Now, this is really a policy decision and not a legal decision. So what does that mean for the future of this pipeline at this moment?
Well, it means that it's still up in the air, that policy changes in a way that law doesn't or not, policy changes much more quickly. So we know we're weeks away from a new administration. We don't know exactly what that means for the pipeline. And so it's a useful and good victory in the here and now. What it means in the future is still, we still have to figure out.
And there has been a legal fight over this. And in fact, from the demonstrators' point of view, it was unsuccessful. Tell us about the legal challenge to date.
Yeah, essentially the protesters filed in federal court, and the federal court essentially said, we feel bad for you, but you don't have any legal rights to stand on here. And the pipeline doesn't actually flow through planned to flow through the reservation in and of itself, which makes it a little more difficult for the protesters and the people of Standing Rock to try to make a legal argument. And so the legal recourse was essentially shut down. And this is exactly, as you said, a policy victory, a victory not in legal terms, but in terms of the people and manpower and what have you that were at Standing Rock that made this happen.
Are there any other legal routes available that could be pursued or at least examined in this period where, for the moment at least, it's not going through?
Well, I'll tell you, I wish I was a clever enough lawyer to figure one out. But I don't really see anything other than, say, an act of Congress saying we're not going to let this federal land be used for this purpose, which then subsequently could be overturned by a later Congress or what have you. But above and beyond that, I'm not sure that there's any legal recourse. But as we've seen, this isn't just a legal decision. This is a decision that that's about public pressure in a moment of changing times.
Yeah, and the political pressure, obviously, the pipeline company saying it was a political decision, activists saying, oh, the first political decision was not to go through Bismarck when you changed your mind about that place. Tell us more about sort of how that looks an awful lot like a political decision not to go through Bismarck.
Well, very much so. Bismarck is the seat of state government in North Dakota. And so the pipeline was, to my understanding, specifically routed around Bismarck. It was intended to go through, but then eventually routed around. And so you look at a situation like that, and you can understand where the protesters are coming from, saying, if this pipeline is safe, if it's something we shouldn't be worried about, then why can't it also go through a city like Bismarck? Why does it have to go through tribal lands? Why does it always have to be that it's tribal peoples and tribal lands paying for the brunt of these types of decisions? What is it about this situation that makes it safe and okay and something that we shouldn't be worried about in the tribal context, but there's no way we're going to put it through Bismarck?
And public policy, Gilliam Jackson, is all about politics. There are political decisions that drive public policy. What do you make of the fact, what did it mean to you to see those veterans show up on the scene, and how much impact do you think it had on the Obama administration and this decision that we've just heard?
It had a tremendous impact. I don't know that a decision was going to come that quick. In fact, we were just all began to think that Obama had abandoned us, even though he said that he would be supportive of all tribal nations during his campaign the first time around. So I think the veterans really made an impact, and I'm so thankful to them.
Well, there was more than just a show of support. There were a lot of activities going on at the camp, including forgiveness ceremonies. We have tape of Wes Clark Jr. He's the son of retired U.S. Army General and former Supreme Commander of NATO, Wesley Clark Sr. He was dressed in a 19th century cavalry jacket and hat as he begged forgiveness. Let's listen.
We didn't respect you. We polluted your earth. We've hurt you in so many ways. And we've come to say that we are sorry. We are at your service, and we beg for your forgiveness.
Wes Clark Jr. asking forgiveness from Native demonstrators, protesters at the camp at Standing Rock. And Gilliam, you've talked about this being a spiritual place, a place of prayer as much as anything. How did you feel about that? And how does this play into that, your concept, your idea that, in fact, this is as much about the spirit and spirituality as it is about public policy?
Well, let me mention another incident with forgiveness. After the dog attack and after the desecration of the burial site, me and about nine other people were invited to the burial site with the tribal chairman and Tim Mintz, who is the historic preservation officer for Standing Rock Tribe. And at the ceremony and at the end, as we were getting ready to leave, Tim Mintz led us in a prayer of forgiveness, and he said, we need to forgive DAPL, we need to forgive these operators that desecrated the burial site, and then we need to forgive Energy Transfer Partners. And that's the kind of spirit, and that's the kind of people that that have occupied Standing Rock, the sacred camp.
Well, and it's a very different tone than we've seen in other kinds of demonstrations and in other public policy protests. I wonder what this means, Gilliam. I'll stick with you for a moment. If you see this as a turning point in the future of environmental protection, the environmental protection movement.
I think it is, and it's, as I've said in other talks that I've given, it's a global issue. I think it has woken the world. We had people coming in from New Zealand, Australia, France, Germany, name it, and it was a worldwide movement.
Keith,
so I think it did really wake up the people, and it's time that we need to start taking care of the earth.
Keith Rashad, what do you make of this? I mean, this can it almost could look like a pivotal moment where we may look back in history. We see the election of a populist who speaks to a white resentment and is successful at the same moment, a very successful Native protest, all in the same month, in a sense. Is this a pivotal moment, or am I making too much of this?
Well, I have consulted my crystal ball, and it's a little cloudy. I don't know for sure, but I think that it has the potential to be, let's put it this way, it is different. It is different than what we've seen in the past. This is not the first time a tribal community has had to suffer environmental degradation, okay? This is not the first time this has happened. This is not the first time that oil companies or other companies have push through what they wanted to do on tribal lands. What makes this different, right, is I'm from North Dakota, okay? As someone from North Dakota, your ears perk up when people talk about North Dakota because it never happens, right? And this is the first time in my life, this is the first time I've ever heard, say, a Hollywood superstar express any opinion whatsoever about what is happening with tribal issues in North Dakota. So we're living in this different moment where we have, I think, two things really happening, right? We do have this populist movement that you talk about, that people are very, very angry, that they want change, and they're willing to do anything to get it. And it's all across the spectrum, right? Donald Trump will be our next president. Bernie Sanders was almost our next president. That people are angry with the system and angry with career politicians that they feel like are not actually servicing them, that they're servicing their cronies. And I think this is very much part of it as well, too, right? Why is it not going through Bismarck? Why is it not going through the state capital where all the politicians are, right? It's the exact same thing. So we're in this moment where there is this tremendous anger at where we're at as a country, just politically. How that manifests itself, I don't know. I don't know how that it's going to end up. But we're also at this different moment where a generation ago, without Facebook and Twitter and all these sorts of things, when this environmental degradation was happening at other places and what have you, nobody knew about it. Nobody had any idea that these things were going on. You didn't have your Hollywood superstars talking about it. And so we're in this moment where we're people across the globe, as Gilliam said, it came to this protest. And since we're able to disseminate information so quickly, the ability for people to learn about and hear about these things has changed the way that we have to deal with them. And we see this in other places as well, too. The obvious parallel is the Black Lives Matter campaign and how we're beginning to see some of the police violence that we've been told about, right? But that some of us haven't always believed has happened. Right. Well, now we're getting evidence of it. And just like with the Dakota Access Pipeline, we're getting evidence of this environmental degradation. So when you combine the frustration that people have all across the political spectrum with government and the changing world where information is disseminated so quickly, it's taking us somewhere. And I don't know where. Right. But it's taking us somewhere. And so it's a different moment. It has the capacity for change. Where it all leads, I'm not entirely sure.
We're talking about the latest from Standing Rock today on The State of Things. I'm talking with Gilliam Jackson, who is a member of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians, and also Keith Rashad, who's a professor of Indian law at UNC Chapel Hill. Gilliam, does this change conversations, or do you think it will with the Eastern Band now, again, of deeper and broader conversations about building more coalitions? How does this change things here in North Carolina for you?
I think that there's a pipeline coming down the East Coast, and I think that that's something that I'm going to be more and more involved in getting people a little bit more awakened. So in that sense, I think that that's something that's a real issue for the Lumbee tribe, and it may eventually impact the Catawba tribe, and I think big changes.
I've got about a minute left. I'm about to open up a big can of worms here, but owing to the way federal policy works, there has been tension between and among tribes, certainly in the recent past. And I wonder, you just mentioned the Lumbee and the Catawba, and now the Cherokee are talking about at least looking into it. Is this a way of bringing people together through the divide and conquer strategy that's been part of American policy for a couple of centuries now?
That has been kind of like the way the government has worked it to divide and conquer. We're going to give you some money, but we would have given you more, but we had to give these guys some money, and it's been that's been the tactic, and it will probably continue to be the tactic. I think this is really bringing all the nations together. It's been good. It's been all good.
I want to thank you all for being on the program. Gilliam Jackson is a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. He's been traveling to Standing Rock to bring supplies. Keith Rashad is a professor of Indian law at UNC Chapel Hill and a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota. Gilliam, Keith, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we're going to talk with a retired psychologist about the power of words and a good metaphor. Stay tuned.